They were high school sweethearts.
We both expected to spend the rest of our lives together.
But when she was murdered, sympathy turned to suspicion. His palm print was on the murder weapon.
No question it was his.
But the mystery was just beginning because...
the DNA was some other male.
Now, as a town chooses up sides and families fight for justice, startling developments in a shocking murder.
When you've got something that was this bad...
somebody's got to pay.
Somebody has to pay.
She was lovely, the young woman at the heart of our story. A beauty queen, in fact. So your first impression is probably locked in. It's very unlikely to change, and certainly that's how it was in Russellville, Arkansas, a town where a first impression hardened like a patch of cement about her, and also, for better or worse, about the young man accused of killing her.
The boyfriend who found the body.
The boyfriend who found the body.
First impressions die hard, including first impressions of murder. And years later in this small southern town, we had to ask, can they ever change? Of course, that question is quite obvious now to Kevin Jones, but years ago, he didn't give a fig whom he impressed or didn't. All he knew was this. He was going places. He was from a good family, lived near a wonderful city called Russellville, and was well-liked. Oh, and was adored by one girl in particular, his high school sweetheart, Nona Dirkspeyer.
So she was kind of like a soulmate, I suppose.
Yeah, I was closer to her than anybody else.
He was going to marry her someday. She was, after all, about the prettiest girl in town. Local beauty pageant judges were wowed by her looks and poise that already crowned her as such. But here's another truth her boyfriend came to realize. Beauty really isn't everything. Nona was a sometimes troubled girl, given to bouts of emotional turmoil. Her mother, Carol, was grateful to Kevin for making her daughter happy.
Kevin was really interested in helping Nona get through some of these hard times she was having. He seemed to be a really caring person.
He even brought Nona into his own family. His mom, Janice, dad, Hiram, treated her as one of their own.
She was not a girlfriend or whatever. She was our family.
When it was time for Kevin to go off to college, he and Nona stayed in touch and in love through a wireless world of late-night cell chats and texts and emoticons. When he didn't respond promptly, she'd wag her finger at him.
And she would send me text messages that said, you know, are you still alive? Sarcastically, trying to get my attention.
Which is why he was so taken aback that day, a little more than a week before Christmas in 2005. It was December 15th. Nona, uncharacteristically, hadn't reached out to him or answered him since morning. At one point, he turned her old taunt back on her, texting, "You alive?" Even then, she didn't respond. This was not like Nona.
4.5 years, we had made a pattern, and that's what we did every day. And if that pattern's broken, it just kind of raised a red flag in my head. Why is she not responding?
Were you worried?
I was concerned.
Who knows why things work out the way they do? On that particular night, Kevin was supposed to drive his mom, Janice, to a Christmas party. She remembers being in the car with him.
And I, you know, said, well, you know, there's lots of reasons why she might not be answering her phone, you know. Maybe her plans changed.
But by now, Kevin could think of nothing else. He called his buddy Ryan, who delivered pizza near Nona's apartment, asked him to check on her. And Ryan called back with something eerie. Nona's car was in the lot. Her house lights were on, but she wasn't answering the door.
And I said, okay, well, I'm going to come over there.
They pulled up to Nona's front door. Ryan was still there, and Kevin joined him.
Ryan and I knocked and knocked and rang the doorbell, and nobody came. And we started to get a little frantic.
So the two men ran around the condo to Nona's back door. Kevin says he rushed up to the sliding glass door without taking a moment to look inside.
so when I was grabbing the handle, Ryan touched me and he said, "Do you not see her?" And I looked at him and he said, "Dude, there she is." And she was laying on in her front room.
Nona wasn't moving. Kevin threw open the unlocked door and rushed inside.
Ryan, at one point, let my mom in the front door. They called 911 pretty soon after that.
Her name is Nona Dirkmeyer.
Nona Dirkmeyer.
I straddled her midsection. My knees were on the ground above her midsection.
He tried CPR, but she wasn't breathing. In her eyes, usually so luminous, there was no light. There was nothing at all.
And I talked to her and just prayed that everything was going to be okay and until the EMS got there.
Soon, the little apartment was overwhelmed by paramedics and police. It wasn't long before an officer took Kevin aside. Janice listened as her son's voice suddenly rose above the chaos.
Then I heard him cry out.
What a howl.
Yeah, that's what it was. And then he asked them if she was dead. And they affirmed that, yes, she was.
Nona was gone. Nothing Kevin could do about it. And as he tried to absorb the enormity of what had happened, he heard a policeman ask, "Could he come downtown, please?" They had a few questions about what happened to Nona.
Did Kevin know what happened? Police seemed to think so. What started as a few questions turned into an hours-long interrogation.
Oh, my God.
When Dateline continues.
In pictures, Nona Dirksmeyer forever radiates promise and beauty. But there is something ugly that lives on, too. Her death and the way she was so brutally taken. Nona's mother, Carol, knew it was bad the moment she arrived that night to see police at Nona's apartment.
I told Mom I wanted to see my baby. Of course, I said, "You can't." So they had the crime scene tape up and everything.
The police told Carol it was horribly obvious. Nona had been murdered. But they were on the case, they told her. In fact, they were already trying to break down Nona's last moments on Earth.
When did you last spoke with her?
About 1 o'clock last night, I called her just from my house phone.
Questioning the man who may have known her best.
You've been in a fight recently?
I've never been in a fight.
And Kevin Jones seemed eager to help the police figure out who killed his girlfriend. He readily agreed to go to the station that night to answer a few routine questions.
What happened?
I called her all day and she didn't answer. I thought maybe her phone was just dead.
But as Kevin careened from what looked like disbelief...
God, get out of this room.
...to grief...
I love you.
...to anger, back again...
A couple questions I want
to ask. A few questions turned into many.
Did you have a key to the apartment?
Yeah.
And were pointed.
Not accusing you of anything. Did you hurt her tonight?
Yeah, you know, I promise you. I would kill myself before I hurt her.
They would leave me alone in the room. They would ask me questions.
Oh my God. Please tell me what my goodness.
After a while, the police told Kevin.
I'll get you out of here.
He could go home. They had other people to talk to, young men Nona had been seeing while Kevin was away at college. But it wasn't long before the detectives determined the alibis for those other men checked out. And 6 days later, as he prepared to say goodbye to Nona at the funeral home, police asked him to come back to the police station.
Can I get a drink of water?
You bet.
After about 20 minutes worth of questions, they asked me if I'd take a polygraph test.
What'd you say?
I said, sure.
Kevin, when I attach this up here, I'm going
to... So they strapped him up and ran through the innocuous questions, and then...
Did you cause the death of Nona Dirksmeyer?
And then they went out, analyzed it, came back, and said what?
The man who gave it to me told me that he had not seen anybody fail a test worse in his 28 or some odd years of giving lie detector tests.
Kevin, there's no doubt in my mind that you killed her.
The murder of the beauty queen was very big news in Russellville. And given the nature of the crime and the victim, so young and pretty and vulnerable, the pressure to solve it from the public and the press was quite intense. So imagine how it was for the lead detective, Mark Frost, given that this was his very first homicide case.
Okay, we're done.
Though, as he talked to Kevin, Frost sounded like a veteran who'd seen it all and was disgusted.
You did this.
No, and I'm telling
you. You did.
I'm telling you, you're dead wrong. I did.
You killed him.
I'm telling you
right
here.
Point blank.
No, I'm telling you right here.
At this point, it wasn't really a questioning. It was it was more of them yelling at me, telling me they knew that I did it.
And yet, the police didn't arrest Kevin that night. Here's what they did instead. They told Nona's mother that the young man she thought would be her son-in-law one day was, in fact, her daughter's killer.
The first thing that I was told was that he was a sociopath with a narcissistic personality.
Nona had been stabbed repeatedly around the neck and chest and bashed on the head. The medical examiner said that was what killed Nona. The police told Carol that this had to have been a very personal attack, not something a stranger would have done, but Kevin could have. So now Carol had two shocks to absorb.
I knew he'd done it. I knew in my heart it was someone that she knew. She would never let anyone in the apartment that she didn't know.
So now, Kevin's horrifying discovery was subjected to a dark and troubling spin. Detective Mark Frost said that to him, the crime scene up there looked staged. And a week later, there was a press conference at which the police told the Russellville public, "Don't worry, we know who committed this crime." Police didn't mention the suspect's name just then, but it wasn't long before everybody in Russellville knew perfectly well that it was Kevin Jones. This is what appeared in the Russellville Courier 3 months after Nona's murder. Nona's killer remains free, and Russellville Police Department has requested formal charges against one suspect. Hiram Jones is Kevin's father.
They tried, convicted, and sentenced Kevin within 90 days of it happening. Now, if you was a stranger walking in a coffee shop, visiting Russellville, and you read that, what would you think?
It bothered Kevin's mother, Janice, something awful when bumper stickers, "Justice for Nona," started cropping up. After all, she loved Nona, too.
The assumption that I formed, and I think many people formed, was that justice for Nona meant...
convict Kevin.
Convict Kevin.
Topping our news, police make an arrest in the murder of a 19-year-old Arkansas beauty queen.
On March 31st, 2006, not long after that Courier article, police finally did announce the arrest of Kevin Jones for the murder of Nona Dirksmeyer. Whether or not Kevin was convicted in the court of public opinion was now apparently irrelevant. He was about to stand trial, and quite possibly be convicted where it really mattered, a court of law.
Coming up, a palm print in blood on the lamp used to kill Nona. Guess whose?
No question it was his.
No question it was his.
But on another key piece of evidence...
the DNA was some other male's.
When Dateline continues...
a small southern city, a local beauty queen murdered, her boyfriend accused of the crime. It was hard to be in Russellville in 2007 and not be steeped in the story of Nona Dirksmeyer and Kevin Jones.
This case probably had more statewide publicity than any criminal case in many, many years, perhaps ever, in Arkansas.
Yet, of course, Kevin had a right to a fair trial, an impartial jury. His lawyers argued that would be impossible in a place like Russellville, so the venue was changed to the nearby city of Ozark.
The media spotlight is on the small northwest Arkansas town of Ozark as jury selection begins in a highly...
to the prosecutor, the trial's location mattered little. What did matter was the evidence, and he believed there was enough of that to put Kevin Jones away for years. Jeff Phillips was the deputy prosecutor.
We believed, and I believe, that the morning of her death, Kevin Jones came in unexpectedly.
When the trial opened in 2007, the prosecutor told the jury the reason for this crime was as old as the Bible itself: jealous rage. Kevin Jones had walked into his lover's apartment that day in December of 2005. and found within it a cheating heart.
While there, discovered either a text message from another person and or a used condom wrapper on a counter, and things escalated from there, escalated out of control.
And ended, the prosecutor said, with Jones repeatedly stabbing Nona, then crushing her skull with a lamp base. Left his palm print on the lamp's bulb.
No question it was his.
No question it was his. The defense didn't even make an issue that it was his.
But it's what Kevin did next, said the prosecutor, that showed how calculating he could be. Kevin left Nona's apartment, he said, with her dead on the floor, then waited through the afternoon until hours later, when he could come back with his mother and friend to find Nona's body.
In my opinion, an intentional attempt to be, to have someone else find her but him.
Trying to make himself look innocent. If that wasn't telling enough, the prosecutor said, then surely this was. The police interview in which Kevin Jones hit his chair over and over. The prosecutor told the jury it was Kevin's capacity for violence in full view. Sitting and listening to this, Kevin's father worried how easy it might be for jurors to convict his son.
It was just a nightmare.
Yet Kevin's parents never wavered in their belief that their son was just as innocent as he told the police he was. They even bet the family farm on it.
We put it up as collateral.
And used the money to buy their son the best defense they could. And he needed it. Kevin's lawyers knew their client had become the local poster boy for evil.
When you've got something that was this serious, that is this bad, this girl was brutally murdered.
Somebody's got to pay.
Somebody has to pay.
Somebody, but not Kevin, said attorney Michael Robbins. They sent the readout of that polygraph to an independent expert who reported that the question seemed designed to make sure Kevin failed. And the rest of the state's evidence, said the defense, didn't wash either. That bloody palm print on the light bulb of the lamp, the murder weapon? Attorney Bill Bristow agreed it was Kevin's print, and no wonder it was. Kevin was frantically trying to save his girlfriend's life, so of course he could have touched the light bulb.
It is a totally innocent situation. The blood got on the light bulb at the time the body was discovered.
When he's trying to revive her somehow.
Yes, the EMT.
Touched the light bulb.
Yeah, the EMT said the lamp was within a foot of the body.
More disturbing, the evidence not collected by the police. Said the defense, first-time homicide detective Mark Frost and the other officers in the department mucked up the case royally.
The only area that was fingerprinted was the area around the body, that there was blood near the front door, there was blood on the Venetian blinds, an empty condom wrapper a short distance from the body. The police go upstairs to see if that's been flushed, do not fingerprint the flush handle at the commode, don't DNA that, don't DNA anything up there.
In fact, the defense did its own DNA testing on that condom wrapper. By the prosecution's account, it was a key piece of evidence, the thing that likely set Kevin off on his murderous rage. But think about it, said lead attorney Kenny Johnson. If Kevin actually saw the condom wrapper, he would have picked it up, would have left his own DNA on it. But
we sent the prophylactic wrapper off to a lab, and they found the DNA. The DNA was some other male's.
Someone else's DNA, not Kevin's. And probably, said the defense, that condom was used by the killer. But who? Neither defense nor prosecution had an answer for that. The DNA didn't match anybody in the database. And Kevin's lawyers did have this, an alibi for their client. Kevin's grandmother told the court he couldn't have killed Nona because he was with her miles away in the town of Dover around the time the state said Nona died.
She is a genuine, down-to-earth, very level-headed person. She was an incredible witness on the stand.
But there was one compelling piece of evidence in the prosecution's case, said the defense, and they just wanted jurors to see more of it. That police video of Kevin.
He didn't deserve this. He deserved a life.
The defense had jurors watch all of it. They were betting it would convince jurors they should change what may have been that first impression and decide Kevin wasn't the killer the prosecutors had painted, but a grief-stricken young man who was innocent. So, what to believe? In the courthouse, the jury wrestled with its verdict. And 50 miles down the road in Russellville, the town cried for justice. If that meant conviction, well, so be it.
I said, it matches, doesn't it? He said, well, it matches Gary Dunn.
Who was Gary Dunn? And what, if anything, did he have to do with Nona's murder? When Dateline continues. Kevin Jones sat in the courtroom, watched the fight for his life swirl around him, and felt in that uncomfortable chair the withering stares of the jury.
They can all look at you, and if you do one thing wrong that they deem as wrong, that might sway them the opposite way.
One facial expression.
One click of a pen, one bite off of your fingernail. You never know how people are going to take things that you do.
He had every reason to worry. Later, the jurors would recall how the images of this crime haunted them.
Blood all over him in the pictures.
The palm print in her blood.
But to the jurors, the evidence, or the lack of it, looked bad for police, too.
The glass door, for example, where the perpetrator went out, was not fingerprinted inside or out. The kitchen floor would have been excellent for footprints. He obviously walked across there. No prints were taken.
They said that kind of sloppiness made them wonder. What else did the police miss? What other suspects?
The police claimed that they had checked the alibis of all these potential suspects.
As well as they gathered evidence.
But what really stuck with them was Kevin, sitting in the police interrogation room, looking to them, genuinely distraught.
I felt bad inside that I was watching him in this little cubicle of a room.
On balance, they agreed. The evidence pointed more to innocence than guilt. After 8 hours, they had their verdict. Not guilty. Kevin was free. Enormously relieved, of course, but also furious at Detective Mark Frost and the Russellville police.
It frustrates me and it angers me that the police didn't care enough to do their jobs the right way. It frustrates me that they didn't find the person who did this.
But Nona's mother, Carol, believed her daughter's old boyfriend had quite possibly just gotten away with murder.
If you think somebody else did it, why aren't you out there trying to find him?
Now, who could begrudge a grieving mother's bitter challenge? Certainly not the Jones family. On the day Kevin was acquitted, they stood on the steps of the courthouse and vowed they would do what it took to find Nona's killer. Kevin's father, Hiram, financially wiped out by the cost of all this, asked his son's legal team for one more favor.
I said, this is what I've got. Don't know how much I need. Don't know how I can pay you, but I need this.
The lawyers agreed to help. They asked an investigator to keep working on the case. His name is Todd Steffi. He is a part-time policeman in Kevin's hometown of Dover, just outside of Russellville. Part-time detective and full-time preacher. What an odd combination, then.
Oh, I used to say it's the ultimate good guy.
And right away, Steffi knew there was a key piece of evidence that demanded a closer look. That condom wrapper found in Nona's apartment. It held somebody's DNA, but whose? Steffi wondered if police cleared those male friends and neighbors of Nona too quickly in the early days of the investigation.
Do they have a valid alibi? Because either I'm missing something or, you know. And so I began to feel like that some of those people maybe needed to have their DNA compared.
So Kevin's legal team rolled up its sleeves and slacks and went diving through trash belonging to those young men. And they got some DNA samples. But none matched the DNA on the condom wrapper. Steffi, the policeman preacher, needed a lead. Yeah, you could say he needed a miracle. And wouldn't you know, he got it. It came in the most mundane way, 2 months after Kevin's acquittal and more than a year after Nona's death, Steffi's police chief told him to question a suspect in a recent burglary, a man by the name of Gary Dunn. Steffi's eyes widened at that.
My chief looked at me and I said, do you know who he is? And he said, yes. He was one of the neighbors to Nona Dirksmeyer.
Gary Dunn, a neighbor of Nona's. He was among that handful of men who'd been questioned and cleared by police. Steffi knew that Dunn certainly would have had the opportunity to kill. His bedroom window looked directly across a small parking lot at Nona's bedroom window. Now, Steffi had to get that man's DNA.
How'd you do that?
I asked him for it.
And he said yes?
Basically. I just asked him if he would be willing to give me his fingerprints and a DNA sample. If I can rule them out, then we're done.
But there was a problem. To get that sample tested, Steffi needed the cash-strapped Jones family to pay for it. At first, Kevin's mother hesitated. The test would cost about $600. But the investigator insisted.
What did she say?
Eventually, she just kind of said something like, oh, shucks, it's just money.
So she paid for it. And what a good investment it turned out to be. Because weeks later, Steffi got a call from one of Kevin's lawyers. The DNA tests were back. And wouldn't you know?
I said, it matches, doesn't it? He said, well, it matches Gary Dunn.
The results strongly suggested the DNA on that condom wrapper was left by Nona's neighbor, Gary Dunn. Now Steffi needed to check out Dunn's alibi for the day Nona was killed. Dunn had told police he was out shopping with his mother around the time of the murder, December 15th. That was his alibi. So Steffi went looking for copies of receipts from those stores to back up the alibi.
This was one of the places we had to check out in his alibi. And the store had boxes and boxes of records of receipts. It was the old-fashioned sign-the-slip kind of receipt.
He's not kidding. Boxes going back years. Steffi rooted through piles of forgotten paper.
How many boxes did you go through?
I have no idea. I don't remember.
Hours and hours?
I think I have tried to forget that.
And just when Steffi thought it was all wasted effort, he pulled out a scrap.
Did you find it?
I found it.
There it was. A receipt that showed Gary and his mom were out shopping all right on December 13th. Not the 15th, when they said they were, when Nona was murdered.
Wasn't the same day at all.
No.
In fact, none of the receipts from the stores where Dunn and his mother said they were shopping gave him an alibi for the time Nona was killed. Police and the prosecutor didn't mention that at Kevin's trial. But now a new prosecutor was on the case, and he found the DNA results and faulty alibi compelling. And 1 year after Kevin's acquittal, Gary Dunn was charged with murder. Many people in Russellville struggled to know what to think. Their first impression was that Kevin Jones murdered Nona Dirksmeyer. Could they believe this latest arrestee was the real killer? And could the state of Arkansas prove it?
Coming up, Gary Dunn was the one on trial. So why did it seem as if Kevin Jones was as well?
First thing you get hit with is your son is on trial again. Even though he's not on trial, he is.
When Dateline continues.
Kevin Jones's parents had won and lost. They had won freedom for their son, Kevin, but had lost a young woman they considered a daughter. They wanted justice so badly for Nona. They spent their last dime to find her killer. And they believed their sacrifice finally paid off when police arrested her neighbor, Gary Dunn, for her murder.
I believe he committed this crime, but that's my belief, based upon what I've saw in these trials.
Dunn's trial opened in April 2010. Hiram Jones listened as the state, which had already tried his son, now argued that Dunn was a sexually violent man who had been stalking the young beauty queen whose bedroom window he could see across the parking lot. His own wife testified he was violent in bed with her, and that weeks before Nona's death, she caught him hanging around Nona's front door in the middle of the night. So, said the prosecutor, the jury could be sure Dunn killed Nona after entering her apartment with the intent of forcing a sexual encounter. And the condom wrapper proved it.
This condom wrapper that was found that had the DNA on it, that did not have Kevin's DNA on it, that had his DNA on it.
So, DNA evidence, a disturbing background, an alibi that turned out to be no alibi at all. In short, it was hard to see how Dunn's public defenders, Bill James and Jeff Rosenzweig, could argue against their client's lies and DNA. But that's exactly what they did, and with gusto.
What you're saying is the state was simply wrong.
The state was simply wrong.
What's more, they told jurors, they could prove it. For starters, they said, the state wasn't being honest about the DNA on that condom wrapper. It was only a mixed, partial match to Gary Dunn, they said, which meant
any thousands, millions, billions of people are also not excluded.
Let me ask you then, is what you're saying, Gary Dunn didn't touch that condom wrapper?
That's what we're saying.
He never anywhere near that condom wrapper.
Well, he was across the parking lot in his apartment.
Minding his own business when Nona was murdered. It's true, the defense said, Dunn was not out shopping, as he first claimed to police. He had simply gotten his days mixed up. It was, after all, 2 weeks after the crime when detectives asked for a detailed alibi.
They asked for receipts. They found receipts. They gave it to the police department.
Except it wasn't for that day.
Well, he cooperated in full. He gave them what they asked him to do.
The defense told jurors it wasn't Gary Dunn's alibi they should question anyway. If anything, the lawyer said they should take a look at someone else for Nona's murder. Her old boyfriend. And at that moment, Hiram Jones realized with dread just where this trial was heading.
First thing you get hit with is your son is on trial again. Even though he's not on trial, he is. That's a part of the defense that they use.
How right he was. Dunn's attorneys tried to persuade the jury that Kevin Jones, the first suspect in the case, had one shaky story after another. The 911 call where Kevin's mother is crying.
Her name is Nona Sturkenmeier.
The defense said Janice Jones and Kevin's friend gave police conflicting details of how they came upon Nona's body and what they were doing to save her.
It is a lie. They are lying. They're all three lying. They're all
Pizza
three.
Boy's lying. Kevin's lying. His mother's lying.
Absolutely, they lied about that. Absolutely, without any question.
In fact, the defense attorneys tried to claim, you couldn't keep up with the Joneses and all their lies. Even Kevin's grandmother, who said she was with Kevin in another town the morning of Nona's death, couldn't be trusted.
Kevin's grandmother knows that Kevin murdered Nona?
I mean, I don't know if they know what they know, but they know they're covering for him.
But the lawyer said Kevin Jones couldn't explain one thing away. That bloody palm print in Nona's apartment. It was his and not Gary Dunn's. Did it work? Yes, it did. After 3 days of deliberations, the juror said they were hopelessly deadlocked. The judge declared a mistrial. But the prosecutor wasn't giving up. He promptly refiled murder charges, and Gary Dunn's second trial began in 2011.
Now, Gary Dunn being tried a second time after his first trial ended in a hung jury.
And this time, the judge allowed the prosecutor to reveal a very dark fact about Gary Dunn. He was a convicted felon before Nona was murdered. Jurors heard from a woman named Kelly Jo Fitzharris, who happened to have the grave misfortune of jogging past Gary Dunn on the wrong day in the wrong place in 2002. She'd been on a trail popular with runners, but it was isolated. She saw a man sitting on a bench. As she ran up the trail, Kelly Jo heard footsteps behind her, turned around, and the man had a huge stick, hit her over the head with it, knocked her down, hit her repeatedly. And as he beat her, she realized the only way for her to escape was to wriggle free, and so she ran up the trail as fast as she possibly could, calling for help, pretending there was someone nearby. The police came a little later. They found Gary Dunn hiding in the water. They arrested him. He spent 18 months in jail. And then, newly out on parole, he moved into Nona's apartment complex, set up house directly across the parking lot, months before Nona's death. Dunn's lawyers admitted it was a blow to their defense.
So we had to deal with it and make it, you know, not make it any worse, do no harm.
Or was it already done? This time, jurors knew the man sitting in the defendant's chair wasn't just a man prone to violence. He was a convicted criminal. So would a town's first impression that Kevin Jones murdered the beauty queen finally be undone?
Coming up, the verdict.
He don't have no alibi, you know, and then that looks really bad.
It does look
It looks really bad.
Will there be justice for Nona and her family?
I knew that they were waiting to see if there would be closure.
When Dateline continues.
This was the third time the state of Arkansas had tried someone for the murder of Nona Dirksmeyer. And the second time, Gary Dunn stood accused. But when they started to deliberate, his jurors weren't thinking about second or third. They were thinking the first. Kevin Jones, the first suspect in this case.
Were you, any of you, suspicious that maybe it was actually Kevin who did this?
I believe the whole jury thought in the beginning that it was, you know, high probability that it was Kevin, because the defense did a really good job of getting us to believe it could be Kevin.
Once again, Dunn's defense had retried Kevin Jones for the murder of Nona Dirksmeyer. But the jurors eventually came to a sort of peace with that.
This is Gary's trial, and we need to look at the evidence that's against or for him.
And once they did, they were troubled. On the witness stand, that jogger described just how brutally Dunn attacked her, just as Nona had been attacked.
That was really a big factor in my thinking, you know, about whether he was guilty or innocent. It tied into everything else, because that's what happened to Nona, all those things.
It showed Dunn was a brutal man, who was also a convicted felon when Nona died. He even lied about where he'd been that day.
He don't have no alibi, you know, and then that looks really bad.
It does look really
It looks really bad.
They also talked about the DNA on the condom wrapper found in Nona's apartment. Some believe the DNA probably did belong to Gary Dunn. But that made them wonder, too.
This guy was supposedly so careful to not leave no other DNA or no other fingerprints in this whole crime scene, then you think he would have been smart enough to take the condom wrapper with him.
So, there it was. DNA evidence against Dunn. Interesting, if perhaps not proof. Circumstantial evidence, which was compelling. They took a poll, guilty or not. Several polls, actually. And then on the last go-round, they knew they were finished. They went back to the courtroom and looked at Nona's family.
Coming up and being in front of her parents was the hardest thing for me. It made me very sad because I knew that they were waiting to see if there would be closure.
All
and we couldn't do it. We couldn't give them closure.
Once again, the case of Arkansas versus Gary Dunn ended in a hung jury. The more powerful reason for that? That first impression among many in Russellville that it was Kevin Jones who killed Nona Dirksmeyer. In the aftermath of the trial, Kevin headed back to court. Not for anything he did, but for the damage he said was done to him. By police.
They just looked at me and said he's the one that did it.
Kevin Jones always believed the police zeroed in on him as the suspect in Nona's death and never seriously considered anyone else.
You did this.
No, and I'm telling
you. You did.
I'm telling you, you're dead wrong. I did.
You killed him.
Kevin sued Mark Frost, the detective who built the case against him, and others too, for withholding evidence. The federal judge dismissed the lawsuit because the statute of limitations had passed. Through his lawyer, Frost denied making mistakes and withholding evidence, and neither the Russellville Police Department or the prosecutor would comment on the investigation. Meanwhile, Kevin has moved on. He married and started helping other people correct poisonous first impressions. For reasons you may understand, he became a criminal defense attorney. And get this. Decided to practice law in, of all places, Russellville. The last time we spoke, Kevin told us he's made peace with the one person whose opinion really does matter to him, Nona's mother. She no longer believes Kevin killed her daughter. In fact, she says she loves Kevin. As for the others, who are more cynical, he tries not to dwell on what they think or whisper about him and the girl he once loved. Donna Dirksmeyer, the songbird, the beauty queen, the girl for whom justice is denied. In 2018, Gary Dunn found himself in handcuffs again after two incidents that occurred on the same night, both unrelated to Nona Dirksmeyer. Dunn pleaded no contest to attempted kidnapping and indecent exposure. He was sentenced to 15 years. Barring new evidence, the state does not plan to file charges against him for a third time in the Nona Dirksmeyer killing.
That's all for now. I'm Lester Holt. Thanks for joining us.